Welcome to Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We're going to get right to it today. I'm going to introduce our panel pretty quickly because our special guest for the show has just informed us he has an important call with the GBI in just a few minutes. So we want to talk to him and get as much as we can before then. So first of all, our panel, Greg Bluestein, AJC political reporter, is with us as he is every Wednesday. Amy Steigerwald, political science professor at Georgia State University, joins us again today. We're glad to have her back with us. And Emily Jones, GPB Savannah, who's been following the Ahmaud Arbery case from down there, is also with us today. All of us will have an opportunity now for the next just few minutes to talk with Chris Stewart. Chris Stewart, the Atlanta attorney, who is one of the team, a key member of the team that is working and representing the Arbery family as they try to sort out the terrible shooting that took place down there near Brunswick. Chris Stewart, welcome to the show. I'm going to start very quickly because I know you do have to get to this GBI call. I believe you were quoted in one media vehicle or another as saying that now that we have a new DA, finally, a special district attorney, Joyette Holmes, appointed out of Cobb County, you're feeling a little better about the case. Is that correct? And what was wrong with the way things were handled leading up to her appointment?
Yeah, that is correct. I mean, there was just too much apparent corruption going on with how the case had been handled with the prior DAs, with the case being moved around. You've seen the investigations that have opened. So it's just best to have a unbiased eye on the case that has nothing to do with any connections down there, looking at the case and prosecuting it.
Emily, you want to jump in with a question?
Sure. I mean, you know, now that the two initial suspects have been arrested, one of the big questions and kind of rallying cries I keep hearing from folks is they're asking about the gentleman who filmed the video. Have you heard anything from investigators? Do you have any sense of, you know, his involvement and what they're looking at in that regard?
I mean, the person that filmed it, he was involved in this. I mean, it's insane. You know, he needs to be arrested. If you just read the police report, Mr. McMichael says Roddy tried to block him in. I mean, he was part of the chase and the pursuit of hunting Ahmaud. That is an accessory to a crime. If you just believe what Mr. McMichael said, and, you know, he even used the nickname Roddy, which is his name. If they don't know each other, how do you know his nickname?
Greg, why don't you jump in?
Yeah, I've got a question. So it appears Mr. Arbery was spotted several times in this home under construction on his jogging trail. He's on some home security clips. Nothing was ever taken or damaged. What was he doing in the home? Is he just curious? Was he just kind of just wandering around, interested in the home under construction?
Yeah, none of that until that's verified by the GBI or law enforcement are we accepting.
Can I ask a follow-up question quick, too? This is separate, but, you know, one thing we've seen a lot of, we know Mr. Arbery was a young man who liked to jog, but what else can you say about who he was, what he liked to do with his personality?
I mean, if you just saw his best friend's interview last night, which was emotional and moving, you know, you talked about the support and how he was somebody that his friends leaned on.
Gotcha.
Chris, can you speak a little bit to, there's been a lot said about the Georgia citizen arrest law. And so can you speak to sort of what that allows, but also what it doesn't allow, right? What is it that if someone thinks they, right, number one, what causes it to kick in that someone can now act under the purview of this law, but also what does it actually allow you to do and what does it not allow you to do?
It does not allow you to do what happened in this situation. You are not allowed to not have witnessed the crime, grab weapons, see someone you think could be involved in a crime, chase them down, and end up shooting them three times. What it would allow you to do currently in Georgia is, let's say you're in the grocery store and an armed robber walks in and points the gun at the cashier, and you're right there, and they rob the place and turn around, and you tackle them and hold them on the ground until the police come, saying that you're under arrest, citizen's arrest. That would be allowed. I mean, you're right there. It happened. You have clear, immediate knowledge of the crime. It's a clear felony, and you tackle them and hold them down. You don't use excessive force. But it's insanity for people to start chasing individuals they think may have been involved in a crime with weapons. What if it's the wrong person? What if it's someone that looks like who you thought did it and you end up killing them? I mean, it's going to turn into the Wild Wild West if this is allowed.
Yeah, the background of this law seems to have been aimed at people like grocers, people who are in small businesses, who, if they spot a theft going on in the store, have the right to hold a suspect and call the police. Not, as Chris points out, the law did not, I don't think, contemplate that you would end up being able, having the power to shoot someone you had apprehended, especially in the midst of what was at most misdemeanor trespassing. Emily?
To return to the prosecutors for a second, you've, you know, expressed some optimism now that there's a new prosecutor on the case, but what do you think needs to happen next, or are you calling for happening next with the previous prosecutors? I mean, there's these investigations into them now, into their conduct, and I've seen calls for their removal, calls for their being charged possibly. What do you think is appropriate in this case?
Well, it's evident Chris Carr is upset, and he rightly is. He not only called for the federal investigation, but I saw that he's activated GBI to investigate them for any kind of prosecution misconduct. It's mind-blowing some of the actions they've taken, you know, as a lawyer or even for a layperson, is to not tell your attorney general you've already been working on this case and instructing police officers not to do an arrest and acting like you don't know anything about it. You're just getting appointed. The case shows some serious issues, you know, and you know your son works for the DA that just had to give the case up because of conflicts, because of who it was that was involved in the murder. Your son works there. You know you're going to be conflicted out. You know, you can't claim, oh, I don't know where my son works. He should have immediately answered that call and said, well, you know, I can't take it. My son works for you. Of course, he's worked with McMichaels, but that didn't happen.
Chris, I know you've got to get to this call with GBI in a moment, but I do think it's important to ask you one last question. There is a grand jury going to be impaneled here, but because of the pandemic, there's going to be a delay in when that grand jury is convened. Two questions about that. One, do you think under these extraordinary circumstances, with the international attention focused on this case, that Glynn County, that the special prosecutor should in fact consider whether a grand jury can move forward under tightened security? And do you think the family wishes that could happen, or as long as the McMichaels are in prison, in jail awaiting trial, is that good enough?
Well, I think, you know, with the advances that we're making with the social distancing, you know, if it can be done safely, then yeah, you know, it should move forward. If it's something where people are sitting really far apart, or with a, you know, how it's getting worked out now, that would be great. You know, the faster justice comes, you know, the better. So if they can make it happen, that would be great.
All right. I know that we're losing you sooner than we had hoped. I hope you'll come back and do the show when you don't have to do these, you know, dealing with people like the GBI, Chris. Come on. Political Rewind's, you know, important for them.
You guys know I'm always available.
I know you are. Thank you for spending a few minutes with us right now, and we will watch your work on this case proceed. Thank you, Chris.
Okay.
When Chris leaves us, let's continue to talk about this case for some time, because we have some interesting new developments. And Emily, I'd love to turn to you, because you've been over in Satilla Shores. You've been in the Brunswick area watching this unfold. I mean, just as a scene setter, what are you finding is the mood over there about this case as it's unfolded?
Well, the mood was incredibly angry for most of last week, as I think it was easy enough to see on social media, even if you weren't there. And then there was definitely a shift after the arrest happened. They were announced on Thursday evening last week. And, you know, I spoke to one of Ahmaud Arbery's aunts right afterward, and she was like, she was overjoyed. She was out of breath on the phone because she was so happy this news had come that these guys had been arrested. And so there was definitely a shift in the mood going into the enormous rally that happened on Friday of last week in Brunswick. But, you know, for all that, there is still a lot of frustration and a lot of, you know, nobody thinks that these suspects being arrested is the end of this case by any means. I mean, as I mentioned, there are calls for at least investigation. Many people calling for the arrest of the person who recorded the video, and also broader calls for change in Glynn County, because that's another big sense I've gotten from a lot of people, is that, you know, for people who live in Glynn County, this is not, they don't see this as the first time that something like this has happened. They don't see this as the first time that a case has been, they feel, mishandled or you know, justice has not been done. So that was another theme I've heard from a lot of people, is this is more of a boiling point, a breaking point than you know, one sudden isolated incident.
So Greg, we talked about the man who recorded the video a couple of times. His name is Chris mentioned it, William Roddy Bryan. He shot the video, Greg, through the front windshield of his car and followed him as Arbery jogged down the street. And then he encounters he shoots the video of Gregory and Travis McMichael confronting Arbery. And then we see the whole shooting unfold. But it is still, as Emily points out, it's understandable why the community down there is not quite clear on what Roddy Bryan's role in all of this is. He claims that he was just, he's being persecuted, essentially, he said. But he clearly played some role in how this developed, Greg.
I mean, he was involved in at least the you know, following the encounter and taping it, obviously. And that sort of looks like the next area of this investigation, at least one of the areas of a very broad investigation. GBI's director, Vic Reynolds, said there could be more arrests, the investigation's ongoing. And, of course, Attorney General Chris Carr also hinted at that over the weekend, saying that this investigation could take us in many different places. And so a lot of the speculation is centered on what will happen to Mr. Bryan. And we just heard from Chris saying that he should be charged. As an accessory, in Chris's words, as an accessory to the crime.
Amy, you're obviously a political science professor, and often when we have you on the show, it's to give us your political analysis, but you also have a great background in understanding constitutional law, understanding the courts. Just give us your overall take on how you've watched this unfold.
I think that there's a couple of different levels to this. I mean, so one is sort of an interpretation of these statutes that sort of sound like they could be good in very particular situations and then are more problematic further on. So this is talking about this citizen's arrest law. So as we sort of talked about, when you think about the shop owner tackling someone, there you go. But now the question becomes, what does it mean to have knowledge of the crime? Does it mean that your neighbor down the street calls you and says, hey, I think a burglary is taking place and some dude did it? Does it mean that you actually witnessed it and so can act on it? So that's sort of number one. Number two is this issue of prosecutorial discretion, which is a huge deal, that prosecutors have a lot of power. Right? Not only do police have a lot of power to arrest people, prosecutors have a lot of say within that of whether or not they want to charge and to particularly give possibly police guidance on whether they should arrest someone. And I think that's really coming to play here and unfortunately is also tapping into sort of other issues such as the fact that one of the elder McMichael worked for both the police force and the DA's office. And so now you've got that they know him, the sort of issues that are going on there and what that means. And then I think the final thing is this issue of sort of in general, like what type of force is okay, right? What does it mean? Even if we say, like, let's say, and I'm not actually sure that I believe this is true, but let's say that, sure, he committed, right, minor trespass and maybe even, you know, took a box of nails from the construction site. Does that then mean that even the police, much less a private citizen, is able to stop him by shooting him, right? Where does that fit in, and what does that mean in the broader context of what type of force is allowable?
Well, I think, and maybe Greg or Emily also know about this, and one of you, if you do, please step in after I've made my comments about this. It is, as I looked at what the Georgia law allows in terms of citizen arrest, again, if it's a misdemeanor, you do not have the force of law behind you to detain, and in this case, shoot the person you think is responsible for violating the law. If it's a felony and the person is trying to escape, I think Georgia statute does allow you to retain them. You probably tackle that person. I think. And Greg, I don't know if you've looked into it, but that's my understanding about how this law works. Although, Greg, what we're seeing now are legislators calling for the law to be abandoned altogether. Greg?
Yeah, and that's what's important to notice of this is hate crimes is just one facet of what lawmakers, activists, community leaders, and others are pushing for. And I don't know how much will be done this legislative session because there's only 11 or so more days left. But they want comprehensive rewrites of part of criminal justice law that looks at citizens' arrest, stand your ground laws, and also Democrats have been pushing basically a database of police use of force, if only to require law enforcement agencies to publish when they use use of force or excessive use of force. And so that's all part and parcel of the legislative package. And I think Emily knows a little bit more about the specifics of the law.
Yeah, and I'll start, of course, by saying I'm not a lawyer. I'm a reporter, so you know, my legal opinions certainly are not those of an expert. But I did want to say that you know, looking at this letter that the Second District Attorney D.A. Barnhill sent, which is now a part of the whole probe into possible misconduct because he sent this letter, you know, advising the police not to make any arrests and things. But he did give this lengthy legal opinion on the case. And the citizen's arrest law was not the only law that he brought up as possibly applicable. He also brought up Georgia's version of a stand your ground law. And so I think that is the area where, you know, potentially, like, at some point, there are limits to the citizen's arrest law, and you get into stand your ground, because part of that, of course, was based on an interpretation of that video that interprets Arbery as having, you know, attacked the McMichaels, and I think not everyone has interpreted the video in the same way that District Attorney Barnhill did, I'll say. But yeah, I do think that, you know, citizen's arrest is not the only law in play here.
Emily, the letter you referred to, the George Barnhill letter, has caused a storm of controversy because he wrote it. And as you point out, it's a page long. We read excerpts from it on the show the other day. He wrote it as an exculpatory statement in terms of the McMichaels, and said he believed that they had every right to defend themselves because they were being confronted. And when they tried to stop him, your right, stand your ground was mentioned, citizen's arrest. But the reason it became so controversial is Barnhill wrote that letter after having already said he was going to recuse himself. So, Emily, the notion that he then says, I'm recusing myself, but here's the conclusion I've come to, has caused him no end of trouble.
Yeah, the National District Attorneys Association actually put out a statement over the weekend, and I spoke to their president as well. And, you know, they're declining to weigh in on a lot of the other elements of the conduct of Barnhill and the prior DA, Jackie Johnson. You know, there's a lot of stuff that Attorney General Carr has pointed to. There's a lot of stuff that's floating out there. But the one thing that the National District Attorneys Association really drilled down on and was like, this is very clearly not okay. This is not what you do, is to remove yourself from a case and then issue a lengthy legal opinion. They came down pretty clearly saying that they do not think that's appropriate for a district attorney to do.
Yeah, and I think sort of following on that, that's part of what also kind of gets into this is this sort of real concern about like what was sort of driving some of the motivations and, you know, the behaviors were sort of at times kind of the opposite of transparent. So the other issue that came up is that supposedly there was a conversation that took place between the prior DA with Barnhill, and then that was not, in fact, told to the attorney general when the decision was made that she would recuse and appoint Barnhill, right? We then have Barnhill list putting out the letter after that. And that really, the problem is that creates sort of even more so both kind of a legal and very much so a kind of public view that there's something untoward that is going on, that this is not sort of a studied, neutral, prosecutorial decision that's being made, but rather that there's more of an attempt, because it was also, I mean, the Barnhill letter is really interesting sort of from a legal perspective in the sense of how he's interpreting both the stand your ground law of sort of who's the aggressor, because, of course, generally when we think of someone pointing a gun at you, that would be the first person who's the aggressor, but also his interpretation of probable cause and what it means to, in fact, have immediate knowledge of a crime, right? So for everything that we know is that no one saw Arbery in the house or witnessed that or had evidence, but instead, right, he interpreted it in that way. And again, it gets into these real questions of what does that mean? What is that stretching? And there's real concerns, which I think is not unimportant to this case, that at least one of the parties worked for all of the different players that we've talked about so far or worked with them or in their offices. So they've known him for a long time. And I think that really does somewhat change the decision of how they're interpreting the information that the elder McMichael then gave to the police.
I want to do one more thing. We're going to have to get to a break and do that in just a moment. But, Amy, I'm going to ask you this because I think you probably have the best handle on it. They're going to send this to a grand jury. Mm-hmm. Now, again, you know, like Emily, I'm not a lawyer. Mm-hmm. But grand juries are not required to bring. You do not have to impanel a grand jury to bring criminal charges against someone you suspect of a felony. I think I'm correct in that. So the question becomes, when you've got a videotape that shows as clearly the evidence that it does of the confrontation and how it unfolded, what's your understanding of why you would go to a grand jury and ask citizens to be the ones who look at the evidence and vote out a true bill rather than doing it on your own? Or do I misunderstand criminal law?
So I should also say that I'm not a lawyer, but I do teach judicial process. So take that however one would like. And I took way too many law school classes.
Right. That's why I asked you.
Yeah. But so when it comes to there are different mechanisms that one can use to be able to bring an indictment. And a lot of times there is an argument for using a grand jury, particularly in cases that have been controversial. So it's a way to make it a bit more neutral and suggest that you are not leaving it up to sort of the personal whims of the prosecutor or the DA's office, but rather that it is charged, right? Because remember, they've been arrested. So, I mean, they had probable cause to go before a judge to swear out a warrant for the arrest. And so this is kind of a necessary check, or another check, I should say, on that power of the prosecutor to unilaterally make the decision. And I think particularly in this instance, they're likely wanting to do that because it gives another layer of both transparency and neutrality.
All right, so that makes sense. So, Greg, in this case, the grand jury serves probably a very important purpose in trying to untangle this knot of apparent conflicts and contradictory statements being made by law enforcement. We should not be concerned that the grand jury is going to meet, Greg.
But also, I mean, it's such a fraught issue in the community. It's divided neighborhoods and divided, longtime friends and down there. So I'm sure that it's also something that gives a little bit more distancing for prosecutors to say that, okay, well, we asked fellow citizens, and this is what they think.
I think that makes sense, Emily. I know we got to let you go, and we do have to get to break. But before that, just very briefly, if you wouldn't mind, we don't know Satilla Shores and the kind of community it is. I think I'm right that it is a largely white community. It's not a wealthy suburban neighborhood, to the best of my understanding. What is the racial breakdown of the? I don't mean exact percentages, but is it largely white? Is it middle-income family? What can you tell us about Satilla? It is a predominantly white community, isn't it?
It is a predominantly white community. I will say, I'm based in Savannah, so I have been reporting on this story, but I don't know the neighborhoods of Brunswick as well as I know the ones up here. But it is a predominantly white community. My understanding is that Arbery didn't live that far away though, and that he ran in the area pretty frequently. That's what I've heard from folks in Brunswick. And I should also say
that
do I have time?
Yeah.
I should also say just that one thing that's really struck me about this case is the way that the public sentiment and the public outcry in Glynn County right now really cuts across most of the dividing lines that we might normally see on a case like this. I mean, it's really cutting across racial division and political division. There's definitely, not everybody is on 100% the same page about exactly what happened and exactly what needs to happen next. But the outcry has definitely not been limited to one group. It's been pretty across the board and across divisions in Glynn County, from what I've seen.
All right. Thank you. We are going to take a break right now. When we come back, Greg Bluestein, you filed a piece in the AJC about how politics has come into play in this case. And you and Amy Steigerwalt will stay with us while Emily Jones goes off to do her reporting from the Savannah Bureau. I really appreciate your being with us, Emily. Keep up the great work down there in Savannah. This is Political Rewind. We'll be back in a minute. I sort of raced through the introduction of everybody to the show today because I wanted to get to Chris Stewart, who had told Tom Faust at the last minute he had to get off the show at 9:15, and we want to get at least as much as we could. So let me back up, let's take a deep breath, and say how glad I am to have Amy Steigerwalt back with us, a political science professor at Georgia State University, part of the A-team, which until the coronavirus kind of overshadowed everything else, was our great team of political analysts of the campaigns. And we'll be getting back to that sometime pretty soon, Amy. But in the meantime, just give us a sense. How are you holding up in the pandemic? Are you sheltering at home? What's happening with your classes? Just give us a little quick update on your personal situation.
Okay, well, thanks. First, I'm excited to be back. It's been an interesting experience for all of this. We are at home. We are really excited that we have enough rooms that we were able to have a office for my husband, myself, and my son, because at times we're all on our required video chats and So that's its own thing. But we're hanging in there. I will say that we're a little bit dreading summer because spring break was kind of a horrible week. And so we're trying to figure out what's going to happen once we get the summer. I think in town, most camps are canceled, and that's going to continue. So we've got to sort of go that one. But it's, you know, it's going to be, it's one of those where, I mean, all things considered, we're doing very well. It's hard on everybody. And so it's sort of trying to make that decision of what's safe and what's not. And we really want to be able to see, particularly like my parents and Greg's mom, but they're also older and in, you know, sort of higher risk categories. And so then you're sort of debating that. But thankfully, the weather's been pretty nice. So we can at least get outside. We are playing and watching a lot of soccer. So, you know, we're continuing on that and we'll see what happens.
Greg Bluestein, speaking of sort of dreading summer if camps are closed, you're still sheltering in place. I know you're getting out to cover news, but you still got your two daughters at home with your wife off working many, many hours over at in her healthcare job. So are you going to be the camp counselor this summer, Greg?
Yeah, I think so. We still haven't heard about, you know, middle June and July for camp. So we're holding out hope that there's some way to send the kids back to camp. And of course, the governor announced just yesterday, there's guidelines for camps to open this week, starting Thursday. But we're kind of also hitting a, settling into a little bit of a groove. The kids are still fighting, and I don't know, one kid stole the other kid's robe this morning, so you might have heard them crying right before we went on air. Yeah. But we're getting there. The Kona ice truck's coming to our neighborhood today. My kindergartner has a final Zoom video with her class, so she baked cookies to eat by herself on video. So we're getting used to this a little bit more.
All right. Greg, let's move on and talk about, again, we're going to talk Arbery for a few more minutes. You wrote a piece, the headline, it was Ahmaud Arbery slaying becomes part of political debate in Georgia. What does that mean? What do you tell us in that article?
Yeah, and one quick thing, I want to just go back to what we said before the break. I got a text from Senator Jen Jordan, who says that and she's a lawyer, of course, who says grand jury is actually required under Georgia law for capital murder crimes, like for capital crimes like murder. So
I'm glad. Okay.
Yeah.
Senator Jordan, thank you for explaining
that. Also gives us an indication that they want, so because capital, not all murder charges would be capital crimes. So it also does give you some indication of what type of a penalty they're likely going to try to ask for. Right, and that also,
or they at least want to keep the door open for
that. It would be supported by the grand jury if they reach that.
Yeah, usually she says that grand jury is required when it comes to the seven deadly sins. But in terms of entering the political sphere, you've seen, you know, candidates hold emergency town hall meetings and forums to talk about how they will respond to this legislatively. There was a big press conference that Emily covered yesterday down in Brunswick from members of the Legislative Black Caucus. Lawmakers from South Carolina and Florida showed up to show unity with Georgia lawmakers. You've seen, Republican concerns going far beyond dismay, and with the Speaker of the House taking a very outspoken role in pushing a hate crimes law to be passed when lawmakers return to session on June 11th. The House already passed that legislation. It's bound up in the Senate. There's no telling what will happen there, but the Speaker is putting his political capital behind pushing that legislation, saying that it should pass with no delay and no amendments, which is a big deal to me. So, and the governor has not closed the door on it. He's not endorsed it, but he's also said that he is not going to veto it, and he's interested in watching the process move along in terms of hate crimes. And this is a bill that was in Georgia law back in 2000, was struck down as unconstitutionally vague in 2004. And since then, a coalition of Democrats and a few Republicans have pushed for it for the last 16 years. It looks like this might be a chance for it to pass.
And when what we should make clear about what a hate crimes law would do if enacted is it would be a penalty enhancement. In other words, if a defendant is found guilty, if the McMichaels hypothetically are found guilty in this case of murder, It would then be part of the sentencing phase, according to the statute that would be put in place, according to Chuck F. Strachan's House bill on this. Right, Greg? It would then be up to the jury. The jury would then weigh in, I believe, on the enhancement portion of it as well, right?
Yeah, there's a series of legal standards.
Or do we need Jen Jordan back?
Yeah, but there's a series of legal standards they must meet in order to prove that it was a crime based on race, gender. Sexual orientation was even put into the House bill last year. That's why it was such a big deal, and that was a part of the controversy as well, because previous versions of the law did not cover sexual orientation. So that was a significant change as well.
So, Greg, and then I want you to go right and add right on to this, Amy, if you will. Greg, your colleague Jim Galloway pointed out in a column at the beginning or at the end of last week that what he thought was different about the Arbery case was that Republicans and Democrats were equal in their condemnation of this as a heinous crime. No one shied away from talking about it as a racially motivated crime. You've got the speaker, as you pointed out, forcefully saying, I want that hate crimes bill passed. No amendments. As you say, that is a big deal to insist on that. So Galloway sees this, and he believes that, to some extent, Chris Carr set the tone for this, the Republican Attorney General. Mm-hmm. But Greg, Are there fissures between Republicans and Democrats as how they're viewing this thing, or has there been a certain unanimity?
There's certainly fissures over how they view hate crimes law and some other changes the Democrats are pushing to the criminal justice system. But what struck me, as well as I'm sure Galloway, is that when you heard President Trump speak about this over the weekend, and he said something to the effect of, you know, he looks like a good guy, this is a tragedy, but he also said this might be more complicated than it seems. And that is not a line we've heard many Republicans in Georgia say. That's not a line that Governor Kemp has echoed. That's not something that Chris Carr or congressional candidates or Buddy Carter, the local congressman, Republican congressman from the Savannah area, they are all saying this is a horrific tragedy. The video is horrifying, and they're calling for thorough investigations, and they're calling for action to be taken, looking into the process of why prosecutors didn't initially charge the McMichaels. So they're not borrowing on Trump's line.
And I think the other part that's interesting is there is sort of a broader question of how that's playing in, sort of as we look to sort of both issues that the Republican Party has had in appealing both to people of color as well as women. They're really sort of hemorrhaging in that sense and have been, in some instances at least, it's been suggested that the party is not really taking very seriously these kind of systemic issues that really confront us, right? The idea that someone who is wandering around a construction site, of whether or not they're doing it for a nefarious purpose or because they're curious about what is happening. I have wandered around numerous construction sites to go check out houses in our neighborhood that are being built. I've never been questioned about why I'm there. I'm also a white woman, right? How much does that play into it? And sort of recognizing, I think this is a particular case, maybe because in part the video is what people sort of first saw and where the attention that came out like sort of first, and that was what blew up, but I think it sort of put into stark relief this idea of why is it that a citizen is going after a guy jogging, taping him from a car, and then pulling out a gun in front of him? And what is going on here? Where does that put? How do we justify this as kind of normal behavior? And I think it's coming at a time where people recognize also that a lot that we're taking much more seriously some of the systemic issues that are existing, particularly within the criminal justice system.
All right, let me do this. Let me get to our final break of the show. When we come back, we've got more politics that we want to look at. Greg Bluestein, I just saw you posted a piece about a new internal poll in Georgia that has some relatively troubling news for Republicans. We'll get to that after we pause for this break. We're back on Political Rewind, a quick program. Now, we're going to talk about how the coronavirus is affecting education in Georgia, schools in Georgia. Will they open again in the fall? If not, how will students learn? How can distance learning work in a state that has such inequitable distribution of computers and resources that underserved families need for schools? We're going to do that on the show tomorrow, and I'm really looking forward to that conversation. Before we talk, Greg, about the poll that you posted this morning, I want to go back briefly. Yesterday on the show, I mentioned that the Washington Post and Ipsos had put up a poll of governors around the country, their approval ratings, and that poll showed that Governor Kemp was way down at the bottom of the heap. This was based on how people felt about their dealing with the virus. Mike DeWine was at the top. He had 83% approval. I think Governor Kemp was down in the mid-30s. But I do think it's important. I got a note after the show saying, one caution, it turns out there were like 219 people surveyed in the Georgia as part of the poll. That's not a particularly significant population to draw a conclusion. But Greg, it does give us some at least anecdotal sense that the governor's decision to start opening things up again has been widely controversial. Yeah.
Yeah, and we've seen similar from a UGA poll that showed that was back in April, but it showed similar concerns about whether the governor was moving too fast, and it showed broad support for at the time for economic restrictions that Georgia had placed on businesses.
Okay, and now though you were at, I think you were at the news conference yesterday. He sort of sent mixed messages yesterday.
Yeah,
he did say that he was not going to allow nightclubs or entertainment venues, bars, to reopen. But then he went on and said restaurants can increase from, what, 4 to 6 to 10 people at a table?
6 to 10.
And I thought, and then childcare facilities could double the number of kids in a class I don't know, 10 to 20, I believe that is. Mm-hmm. Those are kind of mm-hmm. mixed messages, Greg.
And at the same time, not only did we already mentioned the camps reopening, or could reopen if they follow the restrictions, but also state government will start, limited state government agencies will start going back to work. And we're not sure which ones they are yet. We're not sure how it will happen. But that'll be a big test to Georgia's economy, traffic. We'll see what types of changes we see in the general the atmosphere, but that'll start as early as Monday.
Amy, how much do you think all of this is actually going to play into the elections in, especially in November, when we're going to have races between Republicans and Democrats?
I think some of it is going to be dependent upon what the world also looks like come October, November. And so I think, number one, we've sort of realized, particularly in the past couple of years, that the political situation seems to change on a dime, and what the issue of the day is changes very quickly. This may be the longest news cycle that we've had in a while, with kind of a consistent top story. But I think it's an important one, right? The reality is that even if things open back up fully, we are not going to see sort of a swift economic recovery, right? Businesses, many of them are not necessarily going to rehire immediately. I think it's also important to note that a lot of the epidemiological tracking has shown that even when places have reopened, people aren't going. So I think there's also this question of sort of what people themselves are choosing and where that's going to do and how much that's going to matter. And I think it is going to play into this. I mean, to be perfectly blunt, those governors that are doing best in these polls are those that are being much more cautious and urging people to pay attention to the public health issues, wanting to support people in the fact that they're staying home. And I think we're going to continue to see that going on. And I think what really might be the issue is what happens 2, 3, 4 weeks from now, right? Do we start to see outbreaks again because things have opened up? And then I think that's going to, again, sort of potentially reinforce for people the both public health and economic concerns with this.
So, Greg, I didn't ask the question of Amy with much precision, so let me be more specific, although she gave a great answer. The question becomes, Governor Kemp, of course, isn't on the ballot until 2022. But the question is, will the party in power, whether it's Donald Trump in the White House, whether it's legislators in state around in Republican states, particularly, it's going to be punished if the coronavirus is still very much with us. And here's where it comes to the internal poll that you got a copy of. Group backing Governor Kemp, what does it show us first about the presidential race in Georgia?
Well, it shows a very, very tight contest in the presidential race and the races for both U.S. Senate seats up for grabs. Joe Biden was at 47%. Donald Trump was at 46%, of course, within the margin of error of 4 percentage points. So that's a tie. That's a deadlock. And then for the Senate races, David Perdue, the Republican incumbent, led Democratic frontrunner John Ossoff 43-41. With about 8% undecided, the 7% went to Libertarian Shane Hazel. Ossoff's top rivals weren't tested. And then in the other Senate race, Kelly Loeffler, Doug Collins, Matt Lieberman, two Republicans and Democrat, were all, you know, kind of dead even, 19, 18, 17 percentage of points of the vote. And then Raphael Warnock was at 9%. About one quarter of voters were undecided. So really it shows, and this is a Republican poll, to be clear, right? And it's the second Republican internal poll we've seen in a matter of weeks that shows Republicans are under a lot of duress going into November.
Okay, so we don't have time to drill deeply into this, but I'll tell you what jumps out at me, for instance. When you've got a Doug Collins and a Kelly Loeffler, Collins obviously a very well-known Georgian, Loeffler becoming known, they're virtually tied. And then the Democrat who's up there with them is a guy who nobody has known in the state, Matt Lieberman at 17%. You got Collins 19, Loeffler 18, Lieberman 17, and Raphael Warnock, who most Democrats think is the savior of the party. And now this is a very early poll, and we don't quite know the methodology. But weren't you a little surprised by that?
I was, we've seen a few polls showing Lieberman ahead of Warnock, partly because of his name ID, because he has a famous last name.
Yeah,
his father was the Democratic nominee for vice president and a long serving senator up in Connecticut, and partly because Raphael Warnock hasn't had many events, he hasn't had many campaign messaging, he's basically been raising money, and he outraised both of his Republican rivals in the first quarter. But he also hasn't been out there doing that much, and he doesn't necessarily need to yet because there's no primary in this race. It's a November special election, so I think all camps feel like they have a little bit more time. That's why you're not seeing Kelly Loeffler's camp kind of hit the emergency button right now, even though they're not doing tremendously well in any of the polls, even this internal poll from an ally.
A slim majority of voters, according to the poll, 51% approve of the governor's decision to allow some businesses to reopen, while 47% disagree. A higher number, 58%, back his move to lift the shelter-in-place order. 41% disapprove. So it's not surprising that a Republican poll would. We don't even know, Greg, do we, what the crosstabs are in terms of Democrats and Republicans being asked to respond to this?
No, we don't. But it is a well. Both these polls that we've published and the internal poll from the House Republican caucus a few weeks ago are from respected pollsters too. So, you know, sometimes we get these internal polls from groups we've never heard of. This is I've heard from even some of the Doug Collins's it's Kelly Loeffler's critics, I should say, or Governor Kemp's critics, saying, like, you know, that they have to at least respect the poll because it came from Public Opinion Strategies, which is a well-known pollster. But no, we don't have the crosstabs. There's a lot lacking.
All right. Fascinating results. Amy Steigerwalt, you've got about 30 seconds to make an observation about what you're hearing about this poll.
This is an internal poll on the Republican side, which you would expect to be potentially more bullish, and it suggests that Georgia really is becoming a very purple state, and it's up for grabs at both the presidential level, and I'm on some level most surprised, actually, by the Perdue race.
Okay. Amy Steigerwald, last word in today's Political Rewind. Thank you very much for being with us. Greg Bluestein, it was a pleasure as always to have, to have you here as well. Greg, get out there and teach your children math or whatever you're teaching.
I will.
Now.
New math.
All right. Thanks a lot for everybody out there who is listening to the show today. Thanks, Tom Faust. Thanks, Sam Burmistaus. Thanks, Jesse Neiswanger, for holding down the fort at GPB while I get to sit here in the spare office in my house. We'll be back with another show tomorrow looking at education and how Georgia schools are affected by the coronavirus. Until then, please take care and stay healthy.